These are biological, artificial life forms being produced to look a lot like these so-called greys that are not from outer space. They're manufactured in a few facilities, one of them located in the Four Corners area near Dulles, New Mexico. This is a concerted effort to create a false alien threat. If someone comes forward with a dissimilar story, they're blacklisted from lectures and subsequently unable to get their story out to the public or the media in book form or through any other significant channel. But those who create terrifying messages, akin to the movie Independence Day, or certain abduction books, receive high dollar advances along with big publishing deals and film contracts. This is assuredly by design. The power elite want those alarming stories seeded into the mass consciousness, and for the truth to be buried. I have met with people who are funding abduction cults in the United States and Europe. Aside from having interviewed military people who've perpetrated these pseudo-abductions, I've personally been told by no less a figure than the reigning member of a European royal family that he helps fund these efforts. He reasons that the frightening stories need to be out there, to make the world aware that these evil aliens exist and must be fought. He went so far as to say that, in fact, every major earthly problem since Adam and Eve is attributable to the machinations of these demon, extraterrestrials. He genuinely believes this. And he is also the chief funder of Opus Dei, which is the sensitive right-wing group at the Vatican with an internal secret cell operating these programs. Additionally, I was told that his reason for terminating support for a prominent author in this field, who will remain unnamed here, is that his stories weren't sufficiently alarming. He was portraying interaction between humans and ETs too positively. The sponsor only wanted the most terrifying tales put out to the public. A prominent leader of one of these abduction groups told me point blank that if someone attends their meetings whose experiences don't fit the mode of military abductions, which are harrowing, they'll kick them out. So, it's a self-selecting, fraudulent process. This well-oiled machine marches out false, contrived alien encounters. These are then funneled to specific researchers, who then get channeled into specific movie, documentary, and/or book deals. And it's all lucrative. It is being done specifically to generate propaganda designed to marshal the masses against this supposed threat from outer space, there, by perpetuating and augmenting the hoax already thriving. Within the shadow government is a hard-core group of eschatologists, people obsessed with the end of the world who would like to see it go out in one big eco-alien cataclysm, to hasten the return of Christ. This is their agenda. They maintain that the world has to be in the most dire of conditions for the second coming to occur, and they hope to make circumstances ripe for that goal. It is just plain madness. With this degree of hyper, religiosity, fanaticism, and cultish secrecy combined with enormous power, the results are predictably outrageous. A few years ago I attended a meeting in New York with Mrs. Boutros Ghali, the wife of the Secretary General, and some of the New York 100 Inches crowd. A woman approached me to say, "Well, I'll have you know I've read 26 books about UFOs and abductions." I said, "Well, with all due respect, that means that you've incorporated into your awareness 26 times more disinformation and rubbish than someone who's only read one book." I'm not quite sure I endeared myself to her, but it is the truth. I have shared my insight with some very senior military personnel as well as people like Mrs. Boutros Ghali and others. Their first response isn't that it can't be true, but they're just horrified that it may be. Often people ask whether the road that the human race is on is atypical or typical of what other planets have gone through. I think there's a whole range of capabilities and experiences that happen with different people. I understand that there are some extraterrestrial civilizations that have never had conflict and warfare. And there are others that have, perhaps, passed this way, learned the lessons, and evolved to a peaceful world. The more a civilization moves away from spirituality, the more violent it becomes. Here, I mean genuine spirituality rather than religiosity. What now passes for religion, for the most part, is a man-made contrivance, a corruption of its original intent. If a civilization separates from its intrinsic spirituality while at the same time developing enormous means of intellect and technology, conflict is inevitable. Earth is now trying to sort out that dynamic. And we haven't done a terribly good job of it so far. It is fair to say that ETs would be aware of the risks and the pitfalls of this tumultuous transition we're in today, which I liken to humanity as an organism going from childhood to maturity, and we're in this prolonged adolescent phase. We are chaotic and rebellious and trying to find our footing, but we are not yet mature. And unfortunately, some of us are like adolescent boys who've gotten hold of some hand grenades and are pulling the pins out. That being the case, if you look at humanity and the state of the world today dispassionately, and look through the eyes of an extraterrestrial civilization, you know that there is cause for concern. For this rear, son, actions taken by ETs that have contained some of our efforts and clipped our wings as we've tried to weaponize space, are understandable. We know this has happened from testimony by numerous corroborative disclosure project witnesses. Those actions could be considered an act of hostility. However, I view it instead as an enlightened act of compassion. They know that we could be a threat not only to ourselves but also to other worlds. Alas, our technology has marched ahead of our spiritual and social evolution, making us, frankly, a dangerous people. The time we live in is very pregnant, but growing short. We haven't really changed directions enough to avoid some very serious consequences that are a natural outgrowth of our retrograde behavior. If you combine extraordinary technologies with a predisposition to vilify anything we don't understand or control, a very dangerous situation results. So, these extraterrestrial civilizations are monitoring Earth very closely. I have no doubt that this is why many of our military witnesses have recounted these extraterrestrial vehicles monitoring intercontinental ballistic missile silos, weapons storage facilities, weapon plants, space launches and ICBM launches. They want to be very clear that these weapons must not be used and that they're watching our behavior. If we were to get completely out of control, there would be an intervention to stop a worst case scenario from unfolding. We're reaching the point where the Earth will have to end the burden we've placed on her, if we don't lift the burden ourselves. We have another couple of generations to get it right. I would be surprised if we could go 50 more years on the path we are on right now. I was approached by a number of the people who run the super secret projects related to UFOs and advanced energy systems in 1991. They had read one of my early papers about the concept of oneness and our civilization and the experience of cosmic awareness and cosmic people. They emphasized the importance of sharing this information with their group. These were people who called me from the CIA, Lockheed, McDonnell Douglas, and similar operations. Everything I've written was primarily intended for this group. The masses of people simply want to live their lives peacefully. They don't care about tripping each other's throats out. There is only a very small minority of humans who are psychotically violent and controlling. The fires of hatred and conflict that keep getting ignited have been lit deliberately because it's benefiting this violent group. People within the general population have a strong need to know about this information. They have a need to know, a right to know, and a responsibility to act, because they can restrain the worst abuses of a covered group like this if they exert their will. But the entrenchment and the ferocity of some elements within this dangerous group are such that a spiritual perspective needs to be elucidated. This is why, when I sit down and write something, until now, it has been written with the primary audience being those people who most need to hear it. Most people on Earth would love to simply live together peacefully, enjoy their diversity in cultures, have these technologies, and evolve and go on and raise their children and send them to college and have a nice life. It's not like there's 99% of the world's population who's in favor of going hell-bent over Niagara Falls without a barrel. There are a relatively small number of people who have a perspective that is retrograde. They are looking in their rear view mirror and mistaking it for the future. So our task has been to turn their heads and look forward. It is important that we view these very powerful industrial, military and religious interests as educable. We have frittered away the last 50 years while the earth was speaking to us, the people of the earth were cautioning us, the mountains were weeping, the polar ice caps were melting and the ETs have been warning us. And we've been heedless for 50 years. We need to listen and we need to act, now. The people running these covert projects are conscious beings who are educable and can learn and can grow and can get this information and change their paradigm before it's too late. In our own meditation and prayers, we should ask for transformation and enlightenment for these people, rather than creating enmity and tension. So, I said, well, I guess I should be looking to find this person. A month or two later, I was in the gardens where Abdul Baha is buried, on Mount Carmel at his shrine. In through the gate walked Emily. I was delighted to see that she was the person from my dream. But you don't go up to a complete stranger and say, hello, I've had a dream with you and we're supposed to be married. We met and talked for maybe an hour and a half, it was like we'd always known each other. But I still didn't mention my dream. She was there for a convention. And the very last day she was there, I saw her again, briefly. They were about ready to close the gates to these beautiful gardens and to the shrines, and Emily was going to go there and say some prayers. I said, you'd better hurry, because they're closing soon. So, she went and that was the last time I saw her on that trip. Later, I went to the shrine and prayed and said to God, if this is real, Lee, who you wish for me to marry? She's going to have to approach me, with me never telling her the dream or trying to contact her again. Well, Emily was going to meet her mother in London for a vacation. When she got there, she had a strange compulsion to try to write me, but she didn't even know my last name. She only knew my name is Steve. Someone that she was traveling with happened to know my last name, and so she was able to get the letter to me, through the headquarters of the Baha'i religion there in Israel. Emily wrote me a letter saying how much she enjoyed meeting me, etc. That was what I'd been waiting for. I wrote a first letter to her that was just normal and friendly. In the second letter, I recounted the whole story of how we had been introduced and what Abdul Baha said in the dream. She wrote me back and said, well, if this is the divine will, this is what we'll do. We corresponded for a whole year. In June of 1979, Emily packed up all her things. We met in the Seattle airport and went to Alaska for a 10-day courtship and then decided, yes, we would be married. And in August of 1979, we were married on Mount Carmel in Israel. This year, 2006, is our 27th anniversary. So some marriages really are made in heaven. I tell people this story because many people are given guidance that they don't take, because it doesn't appear to make sense. But if it is right, it doesn't have to make intellectual sense all the time. We've had splendid times, a wonderful marriage and four beautiful children. We've done all these things that you're going to read about, and I love her now more than ever. Emily picked out a beautiful silk sari with gold thread to wear at our wedding. She didn't know that was exactly what I saw when I was introduced to her in the lucid dream state by Abdul Baha. When I saw it, I said, this is exactly it. Our first daughter was born on Mount Carmel in Israel, and we brought her home on our 1-year anniversary, so we named her Carmel. After our first child was born, we came back to the United States, and I went into medical school. I went into emergency medicine because I found it not only very challenging, but it's where I could apply the science and the technology of modern medicine in its highest form. During that time, I was involved in running programs dealing with meditation and holistic health. We formed the Shambhala Institute and offered programs on holistic health and healing. For many years, I raised our four children with Emily, was chairman of emergency medicine and worked in an emergency department, and was founder of XETI and the Disclosure Project. Life was quite a three-ring circus. Being here on this planet, to me, is not about trying to pretend like you're perfect. There's a saying that's attributed to a German writer: those who would pretend to be angels are destined to behave as beasts. The scariest cultists ever are the ones who set themselves on a dais. It's better to be who you are and be real and be human even while you begin to bring into this world those attributes that are spiritual and divine. But you don't have to be perfect to do that. There is no one perfect on planet Earth, unless that being is an avatar, that is one of the high prophets or a manifestation of the Godhead. And there are none of them living on the Earth today and haven't been for over 100 years, and there won't be for another 1,000 years. The major prophets or the manifestations of God are very rare. And they're actually a different species. They have a station that is beyond that of the capacity of even a fully enlightened human. In other words, you could evolve to the highest level of capacity as a human and never reach that station. It is another lineage, another level. And that's how important those figures are and how powerful, but also how unique. And that's why I say it's one of the worst things ever for someone to claim to be that when they're not. The most we can do is to reflect the light from that Godhead. We are all relatively imperfect, and we're here to manifest degrees of perfection. And beyond that, nothing else should be claimed. And those who claim beyond that are frauds. Period. I don't care who they are. Only by being who we are and knowing where we are, can we evolve. The South is so crazy, love every minute of it and it suits me just fine. When I was growing up back in the late 50s and 60s, it was really the old South, still. There were wonderful black women that I knew, and they would come up to me and say, "Oh, you're an old soul." They'd look at me and they'd say things about my future. These were very unpretentious, salt of the earth, wonderful beings. You meet people like that all over the world, and you won't meet many of them in temples or in cathedrals or in ashrams, but you will meet them in other places. As a child, I had things affirmed to me from some of these wise and sagacious people. This happened from the time I was 4 or 5 years of age on. I was not drawn towards the trappings and formality of spirituality that gets subsumed into the world of priests and the hierarchy or gurus or ashrams, but was more attracted to that genuine spirituality you find in honest, direct, clear, simple spirituality. Because that's where I stayed, it enabled me to open up my heart and do things such as acts of forgiveness and acts of love that really were outside of what my upbringing should have allowed. The message here is, you can transcend your own limitations, if you let yourself go there. You must exercise your free will to create your own reality. As I look back on it, that was the big lesson of the first 20 years of my life. The specific experiences that I had were in a sense wonderful, and I was blessed to have them even though they happened in the crucible of much difficulty and suffering. It's easy to talk about it, but going through it was not easy. Life on Earth is not necessarily easy. There are perfections and imperfections here, and our task is to manifest as many of these good qualities and attributes and perfections as we can. I had to re-create my life, physically. I had been so sick growing up. I had to reform my body, re-form my mind, re-form my spirit, re-form my heart. It was like a shamanic process. And the way that happened was not only through the exercise of will but also through an ability to transcend my own limitations. You can call this faith, not the faith that most religious people think, such as certain beliefs and dogmas. To me, true faith is a knowingness and a certainty of things not yet seen and not yet fully known. And yet in your heart and spirit a certainty exists that it can be. I found the ability to actualize and manifest through faith and through vision and saw things happen that were miraculous. I remember, for example, being in college after I had learned meditation techniques, and I started experimenting with the power of prayer. I lived in a dorm and there were these guys who were getting drunk all the time and really on a dangerous path. Every year there were a few of these college kids who ended up drinking and getting killed, driving between Boone and Blowing Rock on a treacherous two-lane road. One afternoon I was sitting in the dorm room meditating. I heard these guys come in, completely drunk and rowdy. So I went into a state of divine awareness, And without any irritation or negativity on my part at all, I wasn't judging, I just went in that state and I saw them. In my mind, I could see them coming down the hall. And I put this divine light around them, and I asked for their forgiveness. Then I asked that they wake up to what they were doing and that they stop harming themselves in this way. About 5 minutes later, there was a knock on the door. And there they were, looking completely sober, asking for forgiveness, through me to something greater. It was a transformative event for them, and I never saw them drunk again. That same year, I found that the same thing happens with animals, that there was this ability to connect with what people in the East would call the devas and the nature energies. I would sit out under the trees in a huge ancient forest behind my dorm and meditate. One day, while sitting against a huge old hemlock tree and meditating, I felt I was being watched. I slowly opened my eyes and to my delight, there was a semi-circle of animals around me. There were a couple of birds, a squirrel, a chipmunk and a raccoon, just in a semi-circle. I know this sounds like something out of Siddhartha, but it really happened. These animals were peacefully staring at me and appeared to be in a state of great calm and bliss. We have within us a wonderful divine spirit, but we have to know it, practice it, and affirm it in our lives so that these things are possible. This is what, to me, faith is. You act as if it is so, and it is so. And when you act as if it is so, it will be. Ultimately, it is an exercise of surrender, of gift, in yourself to the Great Spirit. Is always folded within us. It's a matter of knowing this, being open to it and letting it operate. So, you have to get out of your own way and let it happen. When I was living in Israel, my father, who was a chain smoker and an alcoholic, became deathly ill. I now realize that he also had very serious post-traumatic stress disorder from World War II, from doing hand-to-hand combat with the Japanese in the Pacific Islands. One day, I heard from family that he had an inoperable golf ball-sized tumor in his right lung. Back then, this would have been around 1978, it was not thought that the available chemotherapy would work, but they would try it anyway. And so I was called back to the States to make burial arrangements. The doctors said he had about 6 weeks to live. When I saw Dad, I asked him, "Do you want to die from this?" He said, "No, I'm not ready." So, I taught him meditation and I taught him prayer. Now, you have to understand what a hard, boiled atheist, and bitter man he was, and of that generation, born in 1916. But still he said, "I'll do this." So, I gave him some books to read and then I personally taught him meditation, visualization and how to heal with mind from within. You have to first center and go into a deep, quiet state of consciousness that goes beyond self, where the real power is, which is divinity. It's that which transcends ego. And then from that state, do the visualization. So, you bring in what I call the God factor or the divine spirit factor. So I taught my father to do this. I said, "Just do it. This is a matter of saving your life. Whether you believe it or not, act as if you do." So, he did. I then went back to Israel, and I would go to the beautiful Baha'i shrine on Mount Carmel. Every day at lunch, I'd go there and I would do the same visualization as I taught my dad. Then I would pray for his healing. Well, a few weeks later, he went back to his doctor. We did pick out the cemetery plot, but I knew he'd be okay. The doctor took some x-rays and found, suddenly, that the huge tumor was gone. And the doctor went, "My God, it was one of these miraculous, spontaneous healings." But we knew exactly what happened. My father ended up living several more years and dying of congestive heart failure and emphysema from smoking, because his lungs were just blown. But before he died, a memory came back to me of sitting with him in the backyard of our house in Charlotte when I was young, maybe 12 years old. He said, "You know, I really don't want to live much longer, just long enough that you kids are all grown and out of the house." He was pretty inebriated when he told me this. Now, When he had his lung cancer, my little sister was still living at home. And the year after she left, he died. I told my sister, you know, we do create our own reality. He scripted that. The cancer that should have killed him didn't, but he totally gave up on his life and died as soon as all the children were grown and gone. He did exactly what he said he was going to do, even though I am sure he did not consciously remember saying it. So, we're much more powerful than we think we are, no matter who we are. And we do create the life that we have. During this same period of time, I learned that I could be in a state where I could visit people at remote distances. Now, a lot of people say, oh, that means you were astrally traveling. I did astral travel as a teenager, but this was different. What I learned to do was to realize that you don't have to separate the astral body from the physical body, but simply realize that the entirety of creation is folded within each individual. We are truly a quantum hollow, gram of the whole creation. When it is said, thinkest thyself a puny form when within thee the universe is folded. A rhetorical question is being asked which illuminates a profound truth, all is folded within the awake mind within. A relatively primitive way of visiting others through spirit is to actually have an astral projection, where the physical body and the astral body separate and you fly off. But a more developed, simpler and safer way of doing it is to realize that all this is folded within you. By going into a state of consciousness that is non-local, that is the transcendent state of awakeness, every point in space and time can be accessed. And when you experience that, then, using your will subtly, you can open up and see a loved one in another place. And this is what I would do with my loved ones. Just before I went to Israel, I had this shown to me. I had a great aunt who was very sick, who had lung cancer, and was dying. She was one of the few members of our family who really did care for us, so I always felt very close to her. And I remember her as being always very sweet and very kind, Aunt Irene. The day that she passed away, I awakened in my bedroom and she was there. And I saw her as, probably, a 40-year-old woman, instead of a 70-some-year-old woman who'd been very sick with cancer. She was radiant and beautiful. I don't remember anything being said, it was just a beautiful, loving presence and at once a goodbye and a lasting connection. The next day, my twin sister called me and I told her the experience. She said, well, I'm calling you because she passed away. I asked, what time? And this experience was exactly at the time of her passing. So, we're always connected through the oneness of the Great Spirit with each other. It's a beautiful thing to realize, because once we do, we realize that time and space are not barriers at all. I remember one time camping with a friend in the petrified forest in Arizona. My wife Emily was back at our home in North Carolina. Suddenly, I sensed that she wanted to be able to know that she could communicate with me, but I was in the wilderness. So as I laid down to go to sleep under a full moon, I meditated and went into a state of unity consciousness. I expanded into that peaceful state of awareness and saw Emily in our bedroom. Now, Emily is someone who rarely remembers her dreams. I knew she was sleeping, so I went into the bedroom and connected with her soul. I showed her exactly where I was and what I was doing. I sent the message that anytime she really needs me, I'd be there, that we're always together, that we are one in spirit. A few days later, when I came out of the wilderness, I called her. She said, you wouldn't believe this lucid dream I had. You were in this place. And she proceeded to describe exactly where we were camping. And you told me this. And repeated the message I had given her. It was a beautiful realization and it was reassuring for her and for me. It showed us what we can do and that we're never alone, we're never apart, there is never separation. When we chose to unlock the box of separation, we have the key. The key is this awake mind within us and the will to use it. You must have a living faith. Yogananda, a famous Vedic teacher, once said that spiritual lassitude and the lack of spiritual adventuresomeness is why people never grow. Once you have these experiences begin to unfold and you say it is possible, your certainty that it can happen increases, then you do it more often and it becomes more and more and more powerful. A positive feedback loop is created. It's like a snowball going downhill. It picks up its own momentum, but you've got to leap over the edge.